So I want to talk a bit about the pairing interaction and about the near degeneracy that one finds in a particular fluctuation exchange pairing interaction, and how that may either help us identify it as part of what's going on, or throw it out and look for other interactions. So let me say I cheated just a bit. I put at the top there Thomas Mayer, Oak Ridge, Siggy Grasser, Augsburg University, and Peter Hirschfeld, who I've been working with on this. And then we'll get, as we go, to some of the other names that I wrote on the board. But let me start off by simply reminding you of old things. This old thing is an interaction, I believe, that Burke and Schrieffer first talked about. But let me remind you of how it goes. So this is for a single-band Hubbard model in which the interaction is just on-site and up and down. And it's often written this way, and one considers two particles coming in. And if I were to try and write out the interaction, if it were pairing, I, of course, would come in and scatter, as we know. And this would contribute U. And then I could, of course, scatter off particles. But if this were up, then that would be down. And if this is down, you can see I've got to put another up bubble in here. And so this interaction goes on out, and the next term looks like this. And they summed this particular stream of graphs to get an interaction that looked like U, and then it looked like what? It looked like U cubed chi naught over 1 minus U chi naught squared. And let's see if I'm getting this right. I'm sorry. What am I doing? U cubed chi naught squared. And so, I'm sorry. Now I'll get it. Still wrong?
No.
And then they added in scattering interactions that looked like this, maybe not in their first paper, but they added in, which picked up the transverse channel. And so as one began to sum these, this first one gave a U squared, a chi naught. And then as they began putting in more dashed lines, they picked up a U chi naught. Now, if I could factor this for you, there is a point I'm getting to. Somehow this thing is going to factor out into U chi naught minus 1 over 1 plus U chi naught. And that is going to then somehow be multiplied by U, and there's a half. Okay? And now...
Should be plus then.
Should be plus then. All right. Oh, I did this work so well last night and not so well this morning, but let me go on. There's a piece then that comes out of... One second. I see what I wanted. So let me try again. Probably squared. So bear with me 1 minute. Let me get this right. I want a U, and I want to pick up the next term as U squared chi naught squared. And then I want to pick up the rest of them.
Right.
Because I want a U here, and I want a chi naught here.
And minus sign then.
And a minus sign.
That's a minus sign.
I want a minus sign.
Right.
So with enough help, I can get this. Now, what happens, and there is a reason for this, what happens is if you put this transverse part together with this longitudinal part, you pick up this well-known factor, which I wish were well-known to me, but now it is. You pick up this factor that looks like u squared. You also, if I had been more careful, pick up a u. And if I put half of the u with that, and then half of the u with what I hope is now minus a half, u squared chi naught 1 plus u chi naught. Then what's happened is you factor this into a spin 1 part, which is spin fluctuations. And you factored it into a second part, which is spin 0, and in this case, are just charge fluctuations. And I'm sorry, should have been neater. All right. The point of this is simply to say that now if you have a multi-orbital system, which is what I want to talk about, the iron system where we have 5 orbitals and different people number these in different ways, and it doesn't, and they do worse things. Some people use an iron near neighbor lattice. Some people rotate it by 45 degrees. At any rate, within this set of 5 iron orbitals, one would like to write out an interaction. And we had a discussion yesterday about this. In principle, you could write this out somehow in band space. It's convenient, I think, in the case I'm going to talk about, to write it out in local orbital space. And so you have, with a given iron that contains these, you have an on-site interaction that is U N L up N L down, and that's just the usual Hubbard interaction if you go on the same orbit. Then there's a U prime, which is an N L N L prime. So this sums over the orbits. This sums over L, let's say greater than L prime, and this U prime then is the interaction, orbital interaction. Then, of course, there can be a Hund's rule, which is SL dot SL prime, L not equal to L prime. And finally, there's a term called a pair hopping term, and I'll just write it down, but it's a DL up, a DL down, a DL prime down, a DL prime up. And this is a commonly used interaction within the people who play this game. Now you might say, look, there are many more interactions. There are longer range Coulomb interactions. Please.
Well, in the last term, you don't have to put it up down, right? You can just alpha beta.
Correct. And then you, within factors of 2, we're in agreement. So these parameters enter, and now we come to a new group. I may be wrong and can be corrected by people in the audience, but one of the first papers I saw that said, okay, we're going to do a fluctuation exchange interaction of this type, but we're going to do it with multi-orbitals. And therefore, these U's are going to become matrices that describe the multi-orbital system, and there are beautiful papers by Takamoto et al. And then Kuroki et al., I believe, were the first that I saw who used this in trying to describe the iron superconductors. And by use it, they went on to use an interaction. Now the interaction gets, of course, a little fancier. The interaction looks at some stage like you might come in and scatter. and you might come in with K up and minus K down, and you might leave with K prime up and minus K prime down. And this you might do in one of the orbits, scattering off another orbit. As you come in, you scatter on. And so you have a rather more, elaborate object, which is a matrix, which for five orbitals turns out to be a 25 by 25 matrix. But okay, it describes the scattering. And it can describe the scattering that would enter spin-wise. So I should try and decorate this as I go. This becomes the RPA or flex spin. Becomes matrices that are laid out this way. And this becomes, you could label it charge, but these are going to be the orbital fluctuations. And somehow it's going to have an orbital fluctuation. And this matrix is the orbital matrix, but I'll put a C on it because I used O for something else before. And now this object becomes this matrix. Now, why do I torture you with all this? Because this is just one approach to the problem, okay? This is a weak coupling approach. I do so because one now has a piece that one can think of, depending on what parameters I take here in the interaction in moments. If I have something nice and rotationally invariant, I can think of it as spin fluctuations. And I have something over here that I can think of as orbital fluctuations. They're clearly the old charge fluctuations, but they also have this beautiful property that inside a unit cell, you may not have to build up a large charge. You may simply rearrange what you have within there, creating local orbital fluctuations. And the question is, given interactions like this, given a Fermi surface that now let me go to, this happens to be a tight binding fit to a band structure that might be a 1-1-1 material, but I've left out the KZ dependence. And on it, I've made some labeling with colors that suggest that now when you come down on the Fermi surface, the block state not only is characterized by K, but it's characterized by an orbital weight. And there's mixtures of these, but this particular one that I've drawn is a situation where on the so-called alpha 2 hole orbit, there's dominantly DXZ weight. There's DXZ weight on the beta, called the beta 2 by some people. Beta 1 has a DYZ. So there's orbital character to it, and that orbital character is manifest in both the spin fluctuation part and the orbital fluctuation part. And finally, if you were then to try and understand the pairing interaction, it might scatter a pair from here to, for example, over here. So I might scatter a pair, as I've indicated. Then what you would be involved in is grabbing an object like this, L1, L2, L3, L4, K, K prime. And now you've come in with a K, but you're in this L1 orbit. So somehow you've come in with a K, and you have a spin up, and you have an L1. And you've come in with a K down, but this doesn't care whether it's up or down. It's an orbital matrix element, L4. And then you come out over here, and you've come out with L2, K prime. And now I should be careful. You're also on a Fermi surface. So here, you're on the ith Fermi surface. Here, you see I started out, and I was on the alpha 2 Fermi surface, for example. And I'm going to the beta 1 So there are orbital matrix elements that come in to this. You're going to say eventually you don't want to see anymore because it gets so messy, but it's not so bad. 1 and 4 come in, 2 and 3 go out. Okay? It's a rich structure, and the interest, I believe, in it is it's going to make some very definite predictions about what kind of pairing you're going to have. And then the question is, do you see this in any way experimentally? And I think that's one of the ways to test it. I used to say that we were going to test simple models like Hubbard by asking, what's the momentum dependence of the gap? What's the frequency dependence of the gap? But now we have a much richer thing. What's the orbital dependence? What's the symmetry that we're going to get? And is there something special we can see about this interaction that might tell us that this underlies the cuprate, the iron materials, or it doesn't? Okay? And what might that special thing be? That special thing, I believe, is that with a two-body potential, we're trying to form Cooper pairs. You look at a two-body potential, if you're given it as an abstract quantum problem, and then you look at the bound states, or you look at what states you have from it. And I know you can't invert things, even if I gave you all the states, we can't really find the potential. But there will be some potentials and some interactions that show us a near degeneracy between very different gaps on that sort of a Fermi surface. If we see that, I think we're more inclined to believe those interactions are of the type that underlying the pairing than if we don't. And so now, what are those? Well, let me try and describe what they are. The spin fluctuations, as I say, there are many, many gammas. But let me make you, of course, please. No.
So come back to this model. If I look at the Fermi surface, I know there are 3D states that are involved. But on this model, I need to think about the 5 orbital states. Can you just use 3 instead of 5?
Hmm. Yeah, so there's a question. I'm using 5 iron states to try and make a tight binding model of the band structure. There are certainly beautiful papers out there that use 10 or 16 orbital fit that include the arsenic and include the fact that there are per unit cell 2 distinguishable irons. And I forget, but I think it's maybe 16 fit. If I were to use that, then instead of my matrix that I'm telling you about being 25 by 25, it would grow. And I might have a better description. The hope is that somehow the arsenic's energy-wise lay a few EVs, maybe, away from the Fermi surface, and that we can parameterize them back into the hybridization that we take for the tight binding at this 5 by at this.
So he's asking why you can't get away with 3. Yeah. Because there are only 3 at the Fermi surface.
I beg your pardon. Thank you. 3 would be nicer. The difficulty has been in the past, I learned this first from Patrick Lee and Wen, the people who I tried to use 2. Okay? That turned out to be a bad idea. That gave an unphysical Fermi surface out in here, which in a moment I want to make physical, but it gave the wrong structure. So then we tried to go to 3. 3 didn't work because we got structure elsewhere. So then we went to 4 and we found out we could get a pretty good parameterization folding down Wannier orbits, trying to make fits of this. But once you go to 4 and everybody knows iron has 5, then it's hard to give a talk when you say, oh, I'm using 4 iron orbits. You know, they look at you and say, well, look, you know, it's out of hand anyway.
Actually, I had another question very similar related to this one. If I look at it as alpha 1, 2, and beta 1, beta 2. So I have 4 bands, and how do I make 4 and then have 5 and
You need to talk with me in detail. You need to talk with Siggy in detail, and we'll look at the band structure. I should have brought along a picture of it, but it will do it. Okay?
Number of Fermi surfaces and number of bands are not equal.
Yeah, but so some band would be, but I can just. Yeah.
Can I draw it for you? No. But I'll draw something in a minute for you that will help. Okay, when we get to another material, you must wait. All right. So it's a multi-orbital model. What's this near degeneracy business I'm talking about? It has to do with the fact that given all this, then you say, well, what do you calculate? Well, there are a lot of ways to do this. You can solve beta Salpeter equations, you can solve gap equations, you can do various things. One of the simpler things to look at is a coupling constant, okay? And you say, well, what's the coupling constant? Well, the coupling constant is the following. It's this interaction that we have, K, K prime, and you can say, what's that interaction? I'm sorry, I should have finished this. L1 out to L4, and this gives gamma K, K prime, IJ, and it describes this sort of scattering process where you come onto one Fermi surface and you scatter near another, or you scatter from here to there, depending on the label of the Fermi surface you're on and depending on the case. So this is the interaction, and it's much like other interactions, it's just a bigger space.
And at this point, you are completely in the band picture.
At this point, I'm in the band picture, that's correct, because I have my orbital matrix elements sitting right inside here, okay? And so now, you can imagine, I could take this, and I could say, look, there's going to be a gap structure of some kind, and we know that I average that over the Fermi surface divided by delta K squared, and this gives me an interaction strength. How does this look? If this were electron phonon, this would be 2GQ squared omega squared minus omega Q squared, and then you remember what happens. I cut it off, and I take a minus sign, and then I multiply this in ordinary letters, well, in ordinary simple superconductors, by a constant. It's the same all over the Fermi surface. I don't care. It's all that over the Fermi surface. I average this over the Fermi surface. I divide by delta naught squared. And this becomes, and it's awful. People use minus. And so this simply becomes lambda equals this double Fermi surface average that's done on K and K prime generates an N0, and you get the usual, there's an omega Q here. You get the usual omega Q. So this is just the ordinary BCS electron phonon. And if you, not that we want to do this, but you went on to pick up what would ordinarily be there, some screen Coulomb interaction, this would just give you N0. This would just give you something called mu. And now for a moment, we have to realize for electron phonon, the Coulomb interaction is happening over the whole bandwidth. The electron phonon interaction is happening over a much smaller regime. And so this gets renormalized down to something like E Fermi over omega to pi. And this is this famous one that whenever you go to fit tunneling data, you always use a mu star of 0.12 or 0.15. And roughly the reason is this mu cancels out. This number turns out to be such that this is 0.1 to 0.2, while this number up here for lead is probably 1.5. And so TC is some sort of average omega Q e to the minus lambda minus mu star, and then there's a renormalization. But at any rate, that's the old way of doing the superconductors. We got a different situation. We got an interaction. We're going to do the same thing. We're basically going to look at the coupling strength. Okay? That's what this thing looking at, the coupling strength. But we're going to find what sort of gap gives you the best coupling strength. So it becomes an eigenvalue problem. And you can ask, what does the gap look like that within this sort of theory gives you what you want? Now, I see how fast the time runs, so let me comment on what happens. What happens then, and various people have found this, and we found it, you come into a situation and you ask, what is this coupling strength that's going to drive the superconductivity do as you start changing the interactions? And a simple thing is, which isn't necessarily true, is to set J equal J prime and U equal U prime plus 2J And that's what you would do somehow if this were just an atom all by itself. You can use those parameters and then, of course, slide them around a bit because this stuff is in a solid. It can be renormalized. It doesn't have to obey this. But you can start with parameters. They're in this region. And then you can fix U over a typical Hopping parameter, and you can watch what happens. And what happens is you get various if you treat this as a functional and you look for stationary points of it, then what happens is it spits out eigenvalues, which are the coupling strength, and it spits out delta of k, which is the structure. And what you seem to find is as u increases, and what are you doing? You're driving this guy towards an SDW with typical parameters. Now, typical parameters. You take u greater than u prime. If you do that, you'll tend to have the first major structure occur in the spin fluctuations. With these Fermi surfaces, it'll occur near pi zero. And so you'll see that there is structure coming here from scattering across here in the interaction. And it's what drives the coupling up. And what you'll see is a couple of eigenvalues. You'll see quite often we saw things like this. This will be dx squared minus y squared. I'll show you that in a minute. And this one will be an a1g s plus minus. Okay? But you find both of them, and they'd be rather close. And then you come in and you change your parameters a little bit, and the D wave can win, depending on the filling.
But not if you are close enough to spin density wave.
That may well be the case, but we've found very, very much that the spin density wave itself can drive the D wave. Okay? Well, let's talk about it and let me show you. And then in the last 2 minutes, I want to say we're doing the same thing now for the class of materials that we heard about the other day. Okay, we'll talk about that in a minute. That's a natural one, because that's knocked out the hole. And about all you can get on that is either some type of S or D. But let's stay with what we have here for a minute, and let me show you what happens. And so what you find, I want to draw. So what you find is, let me just draw a couple of them. You have right now these Fermi surfaces. And then if you draw where the gap is positive, you'll find, for example, that it may be positive here pretty much all the way around. And then you find that it's strongly negative here, negative here, negative here, negative here, and then maybe weakly here, meaning these negatives that I'm drawing are negative, but they have, I'm sorry, they're not so strong there, and they look like this. So, while over here, this red guy maybe has some wiggles in it, but basically it's positive, and this is what I called a delta S plus minus. Does that make sense? What's happened is, as Igor Manson, Singh, Du, and others have suggested, is there's a scattering that takes you from here to there. But that scattering let's take gamma 1, 1, 1. That scattering tends to peak around this region or around another region in the back. And that scattering is sufficient to drive that kind of pairing. We'll do the D wave and then I'll quit. The D wave comes about because there can be, in this whole process, there can be a fairly decent scattering coming across here. And it's that scattering, which again, coming off the spin fluctuations, is positive and large, that wants to make this plus and that minus. You lose in here with this being a D wave. This gets screwed up. But this becomes plus, this becomes minus. Now you can imagine with this material, which magically has knocked out the hole pocket, that calculations we've been running, once you knock this pocket out, and what you've got is plus minus if you're running off the spin fluctuations. If you're running off that, which is a negative U center, and that's why I put these other names up, but I didn't have a chance to get to them. This thing is a negative U center if U prime becomes greater than U. You can show that it's a negative U center. It may have other names, but that's what it is. It's a weak coupling picture of it. And under those conditions, because it's attractive, it's negative, you want this plus and that plus. And I'm sure we'll hear more about that from Kantani when he speaks. And in this is a weak coupling version. This very term is a weak coupling version of, I believe, what you and Ted have talked about often. Okay.
Yep.
Take a couple of questions here. Thank you.
But when you are coupling between these electron hole pockets, does the same optical prefer, or can it go through different optics?
Yes. What happened? I've erased it, but the dominant, we find that the dominant scattering is intra-orbital, meaning a pair in the same orbital scatter to a pair in the same orbital. There are, of course, 25 different terms in this. And it's not to say that others don't come in, and depending on what you do with U and U prime, but we found over much of what we've looked at that the dominant scattering is intra-orbit. You pick in the same orbit and you go to the same orbit. Now, of course, you can pick one orbit and go to another one, but and it will, they all contribute, but the dominant one we find is that. So that the pair structure that I didn't get to speak about is really rather simple. It looks like a D, it looks like, I've erased it, it looks like a D XY pair that then scatters to a DXY pair this direction. And so as you guys sit, you'd be pairing DXY like this, while up the plane you'd be pairing DXZs. And it has that structure. And you pair them with a plus sign if you're S plus minus. You pair them with a minus sign if you're D wave.
Did you mean XY or XZ?
XZ.
Yeah, okay.
I beg your pardon. I meant XZ.
So, next.
There are a couple of minor comments. So first, when you talk about D squared minus Y squared versus S plus minus, I guess the issue is not presence or absence of hole Fermi surface, although it's definitely absent in this new materials.
No, it's
but
not.
But whether magnetism is with pi zero or pi pi. I mean that you can well have Fermi surface in the middle, but if your magnetism is at pi pi, your dominant interaction is definitely along diagonal.
Sure.
Yeah, and second, really minor comment, that if you start with band language from the very beginning and consider interaction still in the picture that you wrote when hole and electron Fermi surface are all present, and consider in a band picture sign of the interaction between hole and electron bands, which you get from orbital model if you do it this way, then when U prime is larger than U when J is negative, then the sign of that interaction is also attractive.
Yeah.
So you get plus plus right away. It's just another way to say the same.
Sure. It's question is, who's diverging faster? And what happens is, this guy has a denominator that would look in perturbation theory, at least, like that. And what happens is, once U prime becomes comparable with U, this suddenly looks like 1 minus U, chi 0. And then all at once, this sucker is going to diverge just like these guys, except it's going to diverge downward. It's going to be attractive. And in fact, you push it a little further, which people know how to, where there'll be discussions, and you have a negative U center, in my opinion.
Let me finish with one quick philosophical question. You seem to be saying, Doug, if I understood you correctly, that the proximity of two of these channels is kind of generic within some region of parameter space, which is to be expected. And that might be a kind of smoking gun for this kind of approach, if two different symmetries were seen in the same family.
Thank you, Peter. Yes, what Peter's saying is, I should have explained why I'm talking about this. This happens if the dominant piece within this model happens to come out of spin fluctuation. It does not happen if you adjust parameters so that the dominant piece comes out of the orbital fluctuations. I should be careful. It doesn't happen in parameter spaces I've been in. So I think, pardon me, and you sort of can see perhaps why it wouldn't. This interaction is a negative U center. It's attractive. It likes the gap to have the same sign on pieces. It's very hard to get it to make you a gap that will change sign in this way. While the spin fluctuations very much want, in momentum space at least, have this situation. Well, you know, it looks repulsive, it's Fourier transform, it's really attractive, but be that as it may, it's capable of easily switching, or fairly easily switching this guy so he's the winner. In particular, you remove the center hole piece, and it will be the winner. Likewise, as Kuroki showed, if you dope the system so that you really do have a Fermi surface there, and this sort of thing will stabilize the S plus minus. And so these models, although they're simple and weak coupling, tend to make some of us think that you can fit some of the gap structures that have been seen.
I just want to ask, in this calculation, is there some parameter regime in which the sign changing on one electron pocket, a gap would be?
The sign changing one electron, sorry. Let me make sure what you asked me. You want me to remove this?
Suppose I don't care for the moment, for the purpose of discussion.
Okay.
And just ask some gap structure in which an electron, if I focus on one electron pocket,
yes,
it's changing sign.
Oh, yes. I didn't have time to talk about that, unfortunately. But because this tends to be YZ, I'm sorry, this tends to be XY, and this tends to be YZ, what happens is, this guy can very definitely say be negative and easily switch over. It can easily dip down through. And that's what we found that made us so happy, because Clifford Hicks and lanthanum oxide iron phosphide has a penetration depth that looks linear. Pardon me, at low temperatures, that looks like there's a node. This stuff is extremely easy to get S plus minus, but with nodes.
I just want to put that on this chart that you plotted, which was S
oh, you want
over T, but it was fixed the relationship between U and U prime,
yeah,
and J. Do you need to get away from that relationship?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
No. But what you got to get rid of is that pi Fermi surface.
Uh-huh.
Okay. If you get rid of this, it's pretty easy to get. If you have this, it'll remove that, which is, I think, what Kuroki and company first talked about, was it moved you to more an S plus minus. It removed the node. It increased the lambda.